Semi-crazy, I think that's less than most. My delusions aren't quite up to snuff. I see the news, a rag soiled with lies. It only gets love when somebody's died. See the cars zip past the crosswalks. Watch you hurry, a wander to the sky. Boring job, one that's gonna kill ya. Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Welcome, one and all, to Professor Metal's irate debate and calamitous commentary with the Philosophical Chain Gang. Today we'll be discussing the nature of desire and the McRib, why we love crap. I'm your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Bruce.
I'm Sean.
I'm River.
That's kind of an intense topic. I'm not sure if I'm McRibbed up enough for it. It's sort of the wrong time of year. The McRib is out of season, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm. I'm fairly certain it is as well. At least my McRib senses haven't been tingling.
How does the McRib tingle feel? Or could you describe that a little bit? Because I imagine it like a slow creeping hand waving up the back of your head to alert you to the presence of a McRib.
A little bit like that, but also like a deep, empty pit that could never be filled by anything.
Almost as if a void opened inside of you specifically in the shape and general consistency of a McRib?
Indeed, but it never could be filled, no matter how many McRibs you put in there.
I like the notion of the McRib having a season, like there's some sort of plant which only blooms its porky fruits during a certain limited period of the year.
Indeed. I like to imagine the workers who pick McRibs.
Their barbecue-stained fingers.
Exactly.
So let me throw this out there. First of all, why do we like something like the McRib? Very simple, obvious answer. It's fat and salt and sugar. Three of the biggest flavor enhancers there are, dumped into a big pile, slapped between a bun, there you go.
I think there's something else to it, too. The fact that there is a McRib season and effectively artificial scarcity heightens the want of it. Because it's around for a limited amount of time, we still feel that it's necessary to consume of it while it's here instead of fawn after it while it's gone.
Sure, they create an artificial sense of urgency to the buying and consuming of McRibs. Well, they create an artificial sense of urgency to the buying of McRibs. The sense of urgency regarding the consumption of McRibs is a very real urgency. Not consuming a McRib quickly enough could lead to terrible, terrible things.
Well, we do this with a lot of foods, actually. I mean, turkey, pumpkin pie, eggnog, figgy pudding.
A somewhat contemporary thing. Look at the price of Twinkies when Hostess went under. People were selling it on eBay for way too much money.
Well, I think we've all seen the candy companies selling the special limited edition version of something. The one that I will always remember is the Elvis Special Edition Reese's Cup, the peanut butter banana cream Reese's Cup, which, by the way, if you're listening out there, Reese's Company, I demand more of those.
Seconded.
Yeah, but the Twinkie thing was interesting because if you'd asked anybody up till that point, and frankly, ever since they got that straightened out, if you like a bunch of Twinkies, how many Twinkies have you had this week? People are like, eh. But they like the idea that they're out there. The idea that we'll never be able to get one bothers us. And I guess the same is true of the McRib. I mean, I don't go nuts every time they're out, but I like the thought that maybe I could some year get one.
I should be totally transparent about this. I have not eaten a McRib in easily 15 years, so my discussion of it is sans experience. A priori, if you will.
The platonic McRib.
That's it, exactly.
Well, for what it's worth, I haven't had a McRib since 1856.
How's that even possible? You know what? Never mind. But the McRib does have a platonic form. Right? I mean, it does in some way have the penultimate McRib, the final form of a McRib that is anything but idea, right?
Fat, salt, and sugar.
Right, exactly. But it's not just fat, salt, and sugar. It's also psychological, like we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. The McRib is in some terrible way actually an avatar of desire.
And that's fair, especially when you think about it, at least for me personally, in the past, I always remember the McRib as being better than it actually ends up being. Like, I remember being like, yeah, that was pretty good. I think I'll have another one the next time it rolls around. And I have one, I'm like, it hits the pleasure centers of my brain, but it doesn't really taste good.
Exactly. There's that nostalgia that somehow McDonald's has managed to cultivate into almost a recurring cultural amnesia about what the McRib actually tastes slash feels like in your face.
Mm-hmm.
We as a group collectively seem to go, man, I miss the McRib. Even though when the McRib is here, we're kind of like, ah, this is not as good as I remember anyway. And yet somehow we come back to the next iteration. Hence my position that the McRib is actually an avatar of desire. We fill the bucket of the real McRib with all of the psychological and personal wanting that they have just made room for. I mean, it's very clever. It's a very clever way to do it. It's very clever to open the bucket, to make the space for the McRib to be everything to everyone, and then let us fall short of our own desires, which were never promised to us. Because McDonald's doesn't come out with an ad campaign that says, don't you remember how amazing the McRib was? The way its true to pork feel in your mouth made you remember summer barbecues? The way the slightly tangy barbecue sauce brought you back to those moments in your Alabama youth? They don't make any of those claims, because if they did, we'd call them out on it. We'd see that it didn't live up to it. But because those are all within us, we don't call them out. Instead, we come back for another McRib.
After a year of forgetting how disappointing the last one was, that idea, that platonic idea, same thing with the Twinkie, which we like better than actual Twinkies. Yeah, that's what we like. The idea of the food item.
And this, I think, is the core of our question tonight, is why do we attach that to such bottom-end things? Why don't we attach these platonic desires to, I don't know, the Bentley or some other very high-end luxury item that is honestly well-made? Perhaps the foie gras or the filet mignon.
Caviar.
Why are we not all as a culture clamoring for these high-status item foods and instead are clamoring for stuff that honestly could have been scraped out of most bathrooms in a rest area?
I think part of that has to do with accessibility. The fact that the McRib doesn't cost that much.
It's true. Foie gras and all the rest of those do definitely have a price tag associated with their quality.
They have a certain cachet. There is an idea of them. People have an idea of caviar as something that rich people eat. But when you think about it, it's pretty gross.
Well, that you can get things like caviar without having to pay the price. I mean, fish roe is not all that expensive. It's just things like beluga caviar, which comes from a very specific sturgeon in a lake in Russia.
I kind of feel like something like caviar, and the same is the case with escargot, are the sort of the end product of fetishization of certain food items. You know that the first person who tried caviar was the guy working at the fish plant for the Tsar who didn't get to take home any fish to his family. He got the guts and the eggs. The eggs were edible, and it goes through this process of becoming fetishized as something delicious, and then now only the rich people have it. First person to try to eat snails was starving. So there's like a huge number of these cuisine foods that have gone through this process of starting out as, you know, peasant scraps, and then ending up being for the rich people.
That reminds me a lot of this really great story that I've heard. It's about the introduction of the potato by Frederick the Great of Prussia, and he had this brilliant idea for what to do. He figured out that essentially he could have a much more stable economy if that economy was based on two forms of starch rather than one. If you had a potato and wheat or a similar product, you essentially weren't as vulnerable to famines because something had come along and wiped out your only source of basic carbohydrates. So he said, let's introduce these potatoes. These are a wonderful thing. They'll help stabilize the economy. They'll help make the people safe from famine. This is great. So they do. They haul the things in, and they're all over the place, and the peasantry has no idea what to do with them. They try to figure out how to cook these things, but they just seem disgusting. They've never seen a potato before. They try feeding them to dogs. The dogs won't eat them. If the dogs won't eat them, they say, we sure as hell can't eat them. So what are we going to do? Well, Frederick has the greatest idea. And he says, fine, you can't have any potatoes. As a matter of fact, the potato is a royal vegetable, and only the royals are allowed to eat it. So he creates a plot in the middle of the main city where they're growing nothing but potatoes, and he puts guards on this plot day and night, and the guards watch the plot, but with secret instructions not to guard it very well. And then peasants, at the time, knowing very few things, one of them being, if it's worth guarding, it's worth stealing, they go and they steal the potatoes. And they figure out ways to cook them because the potato has been rebranded as the royal vegetable. Now it's the avatar of desire for this peasant, as opposed to this terrible rock that can't be cooked. It just seems to me like that's exactly what we're talking about. This idea that there's a badge value to the food, right? There's a badge value to the caviar. There's a badge value to the filet mignon, the foie gras, all of these things. And that badge value imparts on it desirability?
The reason we see value go up with these foods is because of scarcity, because, like, filet mignon only comes from certain parts of cows, or because caviar is only made in so few places, or because there are so few chefs willing to cook snails in the proper way to make escargot. So scarcity kind of raises the value because all of the upper crust, as it were, wants to eat them and is willing to pay for them. The market reflects that by raising the cost.
Well, I think there's certainly a condition or a series of conditions under which scarcity is a driving factor behind the value of something within a culture. But there are certainly times when scarcity is not a driving force in the same sort of way. I mean, imagine software downloads, for example. They're infinitely reproducible. If scarcity was the only meter of their value, then they would be essentially worthless. So there has to be something else. And I think that this desirability, I'm loathe to say indexing, but this desirability calculation, this desirability understanding gives us a framework that says scarcity is not all there is to it, right? There are plentiful things that are only scarce because they're already desirable.
And earlier towards the top, I mentioned, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas seasonal foods, that the scarcity of just eating those at those times of year, we impose on ourselves. We could put eggnog in this all year round. We don't want to. We want to anticipate it showing up in November. There's no single corporation controlling the turkey and stuffing, potato pie market, pumpkin pie market.
Hey, look, man, I will not have this show become just a mouthpiece for Big Thanksgiving.
They don't exist.
Christmas.
That's my point. We are all Big Thanksgiving. So, yeah, there's imposed scarcity, there's also voluntary scarcity. Another thing I think we should touch on when we talk about the McRib, there is the entire concept of the range of pleasures, from the very basic animalistic to more refined and then into abstract and, even, you know, some would claim spiritual satisfactions or enjoyments, and the argument over which are better, you know, whether we should sacrifice our animalistic or hedonistic urges entirely and go in ascetic directions, and then the middle range of just more refined, you know, the caviar, wine-tasting differences, things like that.
I think that the wine-tasting example is in particular very telling, because it turns out most people can't taste much of the wine that they claim to. They just have psychological conditions that make it an apparent flavor to them because they've either been told or it's been suggested to them that that would be a flavor associated with this. That's why the writing of the label for a bottle of wine is almost as important as the actual crafting of a wine in a vineyard. And I think that that comes into play pretty intensely. If one, like you were talking about, thinks that there are higher and lower pleasures, and one has psychologically prepared for the idea that I will be much happier pursuing these higher pleasures of spiritual or personal satisfaction than I will be with hedonistic pleasures, one is likely to have exactly that experience. Whereas if one has been trained in the opposite direction, that all of those things are a bunch of faffing about, and that in fact you'll be much happier if you just drink and eat and have good fun on Earth and enjoy the hedonistic pleasures, that you will also enjoy those more because you are prepared for them in some sense.
Even in the world of hedonistic pleasures, there's that range of base to refined.
Sure, absolutely. But we set that range. We decide in what way those pleasures are arrayed. Is drinking more fun than dancing? if we set ourselves up psychologically to the belief that drinking is more fun than dancing, we're likely to have more fun drinking than we do while dancing. So I don't think you can take the hand of the person who writes the list away from the list and still have a viable thing. I think there is a range, but that range comes from what we expect more than what we actually have.
And I think in the concept of refined pleasures, there's actually a bit of overlap between the psychological pleasures, abstract thought and spirituality and so forth, and food and drink. If I'm enjoying caviar and comparing fine wines, not only do I get the stuff that tastes good, I'm also thinking of myself as a better person than the schlub over there eating the McRib across the street.
And there's a very good point to be had there. In particular, existentialist way of looking at it, that to some degree, I am influenced by what I expect from what's going on around me. If I go to a very fancy restaurant that I feel I am not supposed to be at, I feel judged for being there, whether or not the people are actually judging me, which they might be, depending on how fancy the restaurant is. But certainly I'm going to expect to be judged as unworthy of this social setting, and so I am going to feel nervous and displeased by a lot of things in that setting. It's sort of Sartre's line from No Exit, right? Hell is other people. Because I am constantly in fear of being judged by these other people. If I were alone, I couldn't fear the judgment of anyone.
Even if there aren't any other people, actually, I think I would, in a fancy restaurant, I'd still be judging myself a little bit. There seems to be some skill or difficulty level in properly appreciating refined tastes, and I might feel that I'm not living up to it.
But if no one's there to view you not live up to it, then why would you care?
Well, people judge themselves internally all the time. You internalize the judgments of others, of course.
Right. I guess that's a fair point. It's almost like you're pretending there's another person there to judge you.
Yeah, you know, like, I'm not getting why this is supposed to be so good. I must not be good enough at enjoying this.
So, in that sense, the McRib bypasses that and gives you a thing that you are entirely able to enjoy without concern over that, because who doesn't understand how to enjoy a McRib?
That's why it's a common denominator food.
Indeed, and I think there's a chance that people who think they are above the McRib, or it is below their station in life, as it were, would still judge you, but at that point, it's kind of a so-what sort of thing. Like, you're gonna judge me anyway. If I'm comfortable with what I'm doing, your impact is very little sort of thing.
But if that's the case, then am I really being judged for the eating of a McRib, or am I being judged for my station in life, the McRib only being proof thereof?
There's the cost thing, and that's one analysis, but I think it goes more than that. Where we're getting to touches a bit on the ethical concept of what is good, and the base notion, starting with, you know, people like Epicurus, which is, you know, we define good by what satisfactions, pleasures, and happinesses we get out of life. Epicurus suggests there should be a broad and mixed palette of different enjoyments, not just eating the same salt, fat, and sugar thing all the time, but having lots and lots of different experiences all across the map. There have been arguments since then, and people should say, you know, we should be ascetic and eschew the pleasures of the flesh, and other people saying, you're getting pie in the sky with that.
Why not?
But it branches out from there as to, you know, a lot of ethical situations. Once we've determined what is good, we can then apply it.
I'm sure everybody at some point has a feeling of, well, screw it, eat, drink, and be merry. The sort of uncaring what you're doing in relation to other people.
In saying that we establish what is or is not good, in giant air quotes, it seems like that's dependent on the person establishing it more than anything else.
Can anybody else tell anybody else that they're not enjoying life right?
But if that's the case, can we establish that the McRib is crap?
You could look at it from a, I don't want to say objective, but scientific level, I guess. The quality of the food that you're eating, its provenance, I guess. The fact that the pork in the McRib is usually, like, mechanically processed, removed from the bone, leftover pork of what's left after you take off, like, the chops and the shoulder and everything. The ingredients and stuff like that, and not necessarily just the branding or badge associated with it.
Okay, so maybe the McRib is not the most prized cut of pork. But certainly, on some level, there is a sense, culturally, that it's more than just not good meat. Like, it's more that it is an anathema to health and joy and a belief in artisan crafting of good things. That this is, in some sense, the avatar for at least a certain segment of the populace of what's wrong with the American ideal.
Well, it is very low common denominator. You know, it doesn't have a particularly complex flavor profile. It's salt, fat, and sugar. As far as, you know, your scientific provenance of it, you know, caviar is some stuff pulled out of the ass of the fish after you cut all the good meat chunks, meat slices away.
Well, if we're going to talk about food that emerges from the butthole, I feel like we cannot ignore giblets.
I try to.
But there are a lot of people who don't, right?
Oh, yeah, no.
The fact that perhaps those in this room, or at least a couple of us apparently, don't love the giblets, there are a lot of people who seek the giblets out, right? The giblet is, by definition almost, not a high-quality piece of the meat of the bird. So why seek out that which is socially deemed to be lower on the totem pole, almost as if it were a prize in its own right? And I think that gets us into something very interesting about this, which is this turning the tables, this concept that in some sense we have taken what was inaccessible, the badge value of the caviar and the foie gras and whatnot, and we've said we're going to stick it on something cheap and available that we can get to. And I think that there is a sense of reveling in the absolute non-scarcity of it, the non-highbrowness of that particular type of food or that particular type of experience. It's the down-home country food. It's the, like your mama used to make it. It's the home-cooked meal. It's all of the things that we have reassigned the goodness from the pie-in-the-sky version to the very readily available. And I think that there's a kind of egalitarian revolt against those things which are marked highbrow that this embodies.
A take that to the upper crust, as it were.
Exactly.
I wouldn't be surprised, though, if in future generations that type of food, that the giblet, for example, doesn't become the next caviar. I feel like that's where caviar started, escargot. A lot of those foods are fancy.
You think they'll be selling deep-fried gizzards instead of at, you know, your local gas station hot case? They'll be selling them at a higher end
Michelin three-star Parisian restaurant that has the fried gizzards on the menu. They're the most expensive item. Absolutely. Sauteed gizzards, perhaps. I don't know.
To me, meatloaf is always the epitome of this process, right? The meatloaf is supposed to be the easiest to cook, lowest common denominator of mixing up a certain kind of food, making it at home. It's nothing fancy. It's just these things in this way that almost anybody can put together. And yet, meatloaf has started to appear in a lot of places that you wouldn't expect it to. A lot of fancier restaurants as this American delicacy. And it's the complete epitome of this flipping the tables thing, because it is so incredibly, it's not even down home. It's not even, this is something you wouldn't see served in the big cities. No, absolutely not. No, it's something that you would see everywhere. Complete ubiquitousness, taken and turned into a prize of some sort. And I think that's really interesting, because when we say we love crap, to some degree, what we're saying is we love that which is disapproved of.
The taboo of the almost the mundane of the ubiquitous, the this isn't something I should eat for whatever reason, be it health or station or what have you, but I want to anyway, maybe because society looks down on that kind of cooking. Yes. Or that kind of food.
Absolutely. There's a kind of exhilaration in breaking the rules that's sort of there in the McRib, right? It might as well be part of the recipe. It makes no claim about being good for you. It makes no claim about being part of a fucking healthy breakfast. It makes no claim about being the finest version. It says, here's a slab of pressed freaking pork. It is drenched in things that are bad for you. It is served up in a way that tells you it's bad for you. It's in a wrapper dripping with whatever McRib's ooze. There are just so many indicators that this is not something you're supposed to be doing, and it becomes a guilty pleasure. It becomes a sin of indulgence.
Because it's only on the menu for a few weeks every year, they don't have to defend it. If they had it year-round, McDonald's would be having to deal with the PR nightmare of it. It's up and gone before anybody thinks to protest it.
I don't necessarily think it's just a guilty pleasure. I think because of both its scarcity and its low browness, if you will, it is the ultimate guilty pleasure. It is the platonic guilty pleasure when it comes to food. It is the what we think of when we think of bad food that we want to eat.
Are you suggesting there might be a reason we're having this discussion about the McRib and not the Big Mac?
Indeed.
Yeah, Big Mac's fine. It's for...
Right.
Yeah.
It's uninteresting. It's not even this fine, right? Because you can find plenty wrong with the Big Mac.
Oh, yeah, it's got a bun in the middle. I got a problem with that.
You can find plenty, and not to pick on McDonald's, obviously, you can find what's wrong with any burger place's thing. But the McRib almost occupies a special space in our hearts and minds, and certainly in our arteries, that takes up something that isn't present in the mundane, the ordinary, the things we can get all year round.
Philosophers, silence! I have created a new game for you to play that I call Moral Combat. To adjudicate this, I have created a new sentient robot that I call Conbot. Conbot, how are you doing today?
Outstanding.
If you would, describe, using only a single adjective, how well suited you are to judging Moral Combat.
Superb.
Conbot, how is the temperature in your cell?
Sub-zero.
No, I mean since we got you the space heater.
Toasty!
Conbot, who do you think would win in a battle between Superman and, oh, I don't know...
The Joker.
Sure, that works.
Joker wins.
Do you have a favorite superhero?
Lex Luthor.
A robot after my own heart. Conbot, if you were to say you had a spirit animal, what would it be?
Batman.
Really? Why?
Batman wins.
In Moral Combat, two philosophers will choose as their weapon a system of normative ethics and debate to the death over a dilemma which I shall present.
Choose your destiny.
I, Sean, shall choose deontology as my weapon.
I, River, will choose utilitarianism as my weapon.
I'm Bruce, and I'm going to go with virtue-based ethics.
All three of you are at the aerodrome getting ready to board your airship when an armed officer comes around with a sniffer dog. You have all your bags on a trolley, and the dog sniffs at both your wife and your bags and passes them over. However, when he gets to your son's bag, he begins to get a bit more active. You look over at your son, and he's looking a little nervous. You know he's smoked a little marijuana in his time, but generally, he's a good kid, and you certainly don't think he'd actually be stupid enough to bring it back on the plane with him. At first, you're quite cross that he would do such a thing and start planning your responsibility lecture, and then you realize... Bali was recently taken over by Professor Metal, and they have a zero-tolerance policy on drugs, meaning your son could be jailed for life, or, more likely, executed, if he does have some illicit materials in his bag. The armed officer accompanying the dog is beginning to look a little more stern with every sniff the dog takes, looks directly at you and asks you to open the bag. You do. And as the officer begins to take things out of the bag, you see to your horror there's a small quantity of marijuana stashed in your son's belongings. The officer levels his gun at you and asks, "Whose bag is this?" You realize you have to answer, or be shot, but the answer won't be easy. You see your wife in the corner of your eye and realize she's about to step forward and claim it as her own. What do you say? Sean, River, you two shall decide the answer to these questions.
Round one. Fight!
Sean, you shall start.
All right, Professor. Well, deontology is an ethics system entirely based around the idea of duty and rules. A person owes a certain kind of responsibility and action, therefore, to a particular notion of what one is offering fealty to, for lack of a better term. In this particular instance, it seems to me like I have a certain fealty to the laws of a world that's attempting to prevent more serious drug crimes. As a citizen, I have participated in and received the benefits of living in a society protected by laws, and as such, to undermine those laws would be to directly countermand the duty that I have by having received benefit from them. I am, as much as it pains me personally, required on some level to turn over the culprit. To deny my duty to the law because it would hurt me or my family on a personal level is to, in some way, circumvent that which I have not only benefited from, but that which I am bound to. I have to turn my son over. I have to tell that agent of Professor Metal's death corps that I must, in fact, sadly, confess my son's guilt.
Excellent. The programming is holding quite well.
Get over here!
Utilitarianism is about doing what is best based on what you feel the best outcome would be, what makes you suffer the least, I guess, would be a good way to put it. And therefore, I would have to give up myself because most likely I have lived the longest out of anyone there and therefore have used most of my potential. I would feel that even though there is some respect for the law, I don't necessarily agree with it, I would be willing to give myself up because I feel that it would do the most good for me out of the three of us to step forward. And that for the benefit of my family, not necessarily myself, I should step forward, as opposed to out my son or let my wife take the fall.
Superb.
Well, Professor Metal only requires one life in exchange for violation of the laws. Whether it's yours or your son's, as long as somebody's taking responsibility for these actions, I can't say as I disagree.
Brutality.
By paying the price for your son, aren't you encouraging your son to break the law again in the future?
Not necessarily. I feel that there will be a lesson here, nonetheless, even though he is not necessarily the one that is punished for it.
Perhaps to steal a page from your playbook, then. Aren't you more valuable to your family than your son? Your son is, by admission of the initial statement, 18 years old. Perhaps he has a longer life ahead of him, but you have skills. You have, assumably, some form of income. You are prepared to provide for your family, whereas your son is not. Aren't you decreasing their happiness over time by not being the person who survives?
That's fair, but I feel that having lived a longer life and experienced more of the world, I have used my potential. There is not necessarily any way to know that my family couldn't benefit more from my son living or being out of prison than myself. To hand him over would be to impede or remove his potential from the world and his potential for doing the most good.
And therein lies the rub. There is no way to tell. Thus, utilitarianism can never properly account for potential futures. It can only attempt to calculate the values it sees in front of it. Whereas deontology is capable of determining which is the right course of action sans any knowledge of future events.
Superb!
With deontology, if we just do what is expected or what is our duty to the rule of law or to our society, nothing changes socially. And therefore, we don't progress as a society if we just listen to what the society says we should do.
Fabulous!
Oh, that's absolutely not true. Most societies say that if rules are bad, that we should change them. That those rules should be changed by actions of the populace. That is a duty also to the improvement of the society to which you owe fealty.
Impressive.
I don't think we necessarily disagree in this aspect. I just feel that the method that we are using is different. The problem with a no-tolerance policy, because after the fact, even if I'm gone, as it were, and it comes out that I wasn't really the culprit, that means that they've unjustly executed someone or taken capital punishment.
Here it comes.
So you suggest that the appropriate way to change a law is by forcing another wrong to be done so that it can be highlighted? Seems to me that deontology would say, no, change the law. Let your son die for the crime involved, then go about being a social activist and changing the law so that other people's children won't die. But to oppose the law and to thus break it as you see fit is no better than to simply run amok of whatever laws you disagree with at the time.
In utilitarianism, dissent by rule-breaking isn't necessarily a means to just do whatever you want or get away with it, but to point out wrongdoings. But the thing is, I think that utilitarianism sees the necessity of actions over words, taking actions to dissent as opposed to just saying, we don't agree with this.
Annihilated.
Fair, but deontology allows for action also when a law is immoral by breaking the deontological standard. If the law is zero tolerance to drugs, it's still an attempt to keep safe the members of society and fulfill the social contract. If, on the other hand, the law were roving death squads that shoot whoever they feel like, whenever they feel like, that would be violating the social contract and not taking care of the citizens.
Actually, about the roving deaths, you know what, never mind.
Heroic brutality.
Deontology allows for taking action when the deontological principle has been violated. Obviously, we have to talk about the morality of laws and not the legality of laws within a moral discussion, so the only analysis I can make is that if a law is immoral because it violates the deontological principle, then action is required. Otherwise, you have to work within the system because you benefit from the system.
I guess where we disagree on this is I believe utilitarianism would view this law as immoral because instead of doing things like rehabilitating offenders or giving them a second chance, a way to learn from their mistake and grow from it, they take the harshest possible action and therefore do not allow for growth socially.
And here we come to the essential problem, in my opinion, with utilitarian ethics, that essentially all of this is based on your calculus that those things would provide greater happiness to the greater number of people, whereas someone else's calculus might be that dealing with drug crimes harshly prevents more serious drug crimes and thus provides the greatest happiness to the greatest number of people. If any calculus from any person can be a valid calculus under this system, then any action is permissible given the right calculus. Essentially, deontology escapes this because duties are not recalculated per individual.
Excellent.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I feel that duty is a subjective thing and that it would change from person to person what they feel their duty is.
Oh, sure. A person can feel that they have a duty to one thing or another or not to this and not to that as they please. They'll just be wrong.
According to who?
The deontological authorities? Allow me to clarify. In our example before, the deontological authorities are the men with the guns, and the man they serve, Professor Metal.
Well, maybe in this case, Professor Metal is wrong, and by dissenting, should be proven such.
Choose your side.
I'm sorry. What did you just say?
In this hypothetical situation in which we are talking about, perhaps the hypothetical Professor Metal is wrong.
I am wrong, never. Not even in hypothetical situations. This is a hypothetical situation, for you will never have a wife or children to possibly be taking to Bali, which I will rule with an iron fist. Steve, have the death squads come in and take him away.
Fatality.
No, please, no!
Sean, this round of moral combat goes to you. And as such, you'll be fed this week.
I do like food, but somehow it feels like a pyrrhic victory.
Flawless victory.
Bruce, today I grant unto you the last word.
Okay, well, today we talked about desire, and the McRib is sort of a stand-in for base or simple pleasures that anyone can relate to. There is actually a central point in ethical philosophy that comes from this very early on when people need to decide what is good in order to use as a base. For example, for utilitarian calculus, we start with hedonism is the most basic, simple, obvious answer. Pleasure that can be derived from simple animal means, sex, food, comfort. But throughout history, we've sort of looked down on that basic animal craving satisfaction, and we've tried to find satisfactions that are more abstract. They're either, to some extent, more refined pleasures or more varied pleasures, following Epicurus' discussion of all things in moderation and moderation in all things, which also assumes having many things. And from beyond that into Christian medieval asceticism, or asceticism that we see in Eastern cultures such as Zen Buddhism or the Hindu yogi, the old man on the mountain concept. And so we get a whole range of pleasures, from the basic, something that's easily accessible to every single human being, to those more refined, stratified, or spiritual ones, which someone has to go through levels of impersonal improvement in order to be able to properly appreciate. We've also looked up at those people who've been able to best appreciate whether they're refined hedonistic values or beyond into spiritual and abstract pleasures and enjoyments. I'm not sure why. It might be to some extent a class thing. It might be that we all hope to be able to appreciate life in ways beyond what we do now. But the fact can't be denied that everybody, regardless of what level of personal or spiritual enlightenment they've achieved, from time to time, they can still enjoy a McRib.
Thank you for joining us for Professor Metal's Irate Debate and Calamitous Commentary with the Philosophical Chain Gang. Don't forget to subscribe and review on iTunes, support us on Patreon, and view our social media links in the show notes. I'm Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm Bruce. Where's River?
His name was River.
Oh.
Security, slavery, it's better than the dark.